This is Maria Rizaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. Welcome to episode 15 of New Voices, and this week we cover the sacred and the profane, and also a few profanities. So if you're sensitive, please stop listening now. But if you think you've got what it takes to get through this, you're in for a treat, because we do have two brilliant and exciting talents. That astonishing Australian musician and oud player, Joseph Tawadros, critiquing a striking new writer, Loretta Jessop. Both are rule breakers, but not in the traditional way of being a bad boy or a bad girl, just that they ignore the rules in order to follow the force of their creativity. Loretta is just brimming with originality. She has a quicksilver mind and she makes razor-sharp observations. And she targets society's most sacred institutions, motherhood, politicians, government departments, and of course that most sacred institution of all, Sydney's Cafe Society. Loretta's unfinished novel is sweet, it's slicing, and takes her key character through the highs and lows of Sydney life in the 3 days leading up to the Martin Place siege in 2014. It's a wonderful exposition of modern life seen with clarity and curiosity and a little bit of yearning for something better. It is inspired, she says, by that classic piece of literature, Salinger's Catcher in the Rye. And talking about turning the classical world on its head, we have as our critiquer, Joseph Tawadros. If you've ever heard of the oud, then you certainly have heard of Joseph, who is the master of this instrument. And if you've ever heard him play, well, it's something you simply won't forget. And he spreads himself around, going to the country, playing in dark bars in Marrickville, and frequenting a lot of cafes. In between sets, he engages his audience in a banter that is, well, sweet and slicing and very funny. I knew that Joseph would be the perfect person to critique an original talent like Loretta. Gosh, I'm just reading his Wikipedia entry. Okay, it's daunting. He's played for the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. He's had global acclaim, so much so that he's now partly based in London and has won the ARIA Award for Best World Music Album 3 years in a row. I mean, how did he end up on this program? Well, he does say he's a man of the people. And it is about gathering experiences to enrich his music, he says. True to his word, Joseph agreed to be interviewed from London. And like all Australians, claims his right to a unique expression of himself, without fear or favour, addressing colour, he says, shrugging nonchalantly about his bright and spectacular wardrobe. Well, he dresses in colour, he plays in colour, and he critiques in colour. And we are officially enriched by his critique, as we are by the bright new talent that is Loretta Jessop. Loretta, welcome to the program.
Hi, Maria. How are you?
You've been a critiquer on this program before. Mm-hmm. I'm wanting you to give us a little bit of a background, what your day job is, you know, where you're going. No, you don't want to discuss it. She shook her head. Okay, this is not good radio, everyone. What I do know, though, is that you're working on a really interesting book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so it started off as a TV project. It was based on my experiences working in government and just looking at how bureaucracy worked and how it didn't work. And took it to some producers and they said it was great, it was fantastic, but they already had a show about government on television. It was gut-wrenching. Thought, well, I'll just try and write my story as a book. Book is a bit more inspired by Catcher in the Rye.
That was the thing that actually caught all our imagination. The first day you sat down and you said, it's a female version of Catcher in the Rye. What is it about that story that caught your interest?
I think that book really encapsulates loneliness and isolation and belonging. When I went to uni and I did my thesis, and that looked at friendship and belonging and what it means to belong in a place and to not, you know, the power structures that are in place in the everyday and how we navigate those sort of norms.
When did you first read Catcher in the Rye?
I think I was mid-20s. I think a lot of people read it when they're younger.
And you're only in your early 30s now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not
I
much
I can say that for a little while longer. Yeah. Themes of Catcher in the Rye, just that loneliness and isolation and what does that look like in our world? We all live digitally. We don't see each other as much. We're friends, but we're talking via email, via messenger. We're filling our lives with a lot of distractions like food and pop culture, and I think there's a lot of parallels that can be drawn.
You've told me, to my surprise, quite introverted, because so much of what happens in your book and your writing picked up every tiny minute cell of activity around you. So how do you keep those two elements together, your introvertness and this engagement with life?
I think they're a perfect match. Having that writer-observer is a veil to go out into the public, feel that you're cloaked in this safety, that you can be out in the group and you listen and you absorb like a sponge. Being able to sit somewhere in a place and be comfortable in your own silence if everyone else is making noise is when you can make those observations.
When did you decide that you were going to write? You know, and how long have you been working on this particular work?
Well, I was doing a contract for New South Wales Government, and I just thought, if I have to swipe my ID card to use the bathroom one more time or to hear these conversations in the water cooler about someone renovating their lounge room again for like the 100th time, I thought I was just going to lose it.
Yeah.
And I needed a creative outlet. So yeah. I dabbled with some short stories and submitted a few things. Actually went, okay, I think I'm going to really put a lot of time and passion into having writing. Started trying to mine all my experience in government into what that could look like for television, because I'm a more visual person and I just didn't have the faith that I could write. And so then when the TV shows hit that sort of crossroads and I thought, well, what way do I go? That's when I decided on the book, and that was September of last year, so it's 1 year.
Because to tell you, listener, like the first time she sat down and read some of her story out, everyone was laughing and so impressed. So what did it feel like when started to tell that story to groups and it was hitting home, it was hitting the bases that you wanted to hit?
Yeah, it's funny because when I read it out, I get so nervous. As you know, my voice will quiver and I'm always so doubtful, and you've got that little voice inside your head going, oh, they're just trying to be nice to you. And on one hand, you know, my ego loves hearing people laugh when I read it out, yeah, because that's the reaction I want. And
yeah,
there's a lot of messages that are quite significant that I want to say, and I think humour is the best way to get them across, so yeah, that people aren't feeling like I'm trying to dictate to them or spoon-feed them. So, yeah, it's been great having the group and having people, you know, laugh of their own accord. And
I just want you to describe your character
so
people know who they're going to be listening to.
Well, actually, we don't know her real name because every character she meets in the book has a different nickname for her. And I've done that on purpose because one of the symbols I have in the book is the ibis.
Right.
And you might look at the ibis and you think bin chicken, tip turkey, rubbish raptor. You know, it's got lots of nicknames as well. And I think in the city, you might look at the ibis and you think it doesn't really belong, but ultimately it's found its home here. I have Christine in a very similar position where she's navigating the city over these 3 days. She's going into cafes or bars or various institutions and meeting characters. And along the way, she reveals how she's lost 4 jobs with government over the last 2 years. And while she's doing that, she's ultimately taking a selfie of what it is to live in modern Sydney.
So it's like a verbal or a literary selfie.
It opens in the way that Catch from the Rye does, in that you have the protagonist say, this is what happened to me at Christmas, and then they go back and tell the story. And that story takes place over 3 days in December, and it all culminates around the time of the Martin Place siege.
Wow. So what are those political issues?
Important.
I can't believe I'm bringing this up. You know, because last time I could not shut you up.
well, that's why I've said it in 2014, because that way we can see what has come about as a result of things that took place back then. We didn't have equal rights for same-sex marriage, but we had Barnaby Joyce saying marriage is a
sacred institution.
Sacred. And then look what happened to him. Yeah. And then we had Fred Nile also waving that flag in Sydney. And he is married now to someone who biologically could be his granddaughter. You know? We had Barangaroo go up.
Yes.
Whereas legally you could only have one casino. We had Tony Abbott become Prime Minister. A whole lot of housing commission in inner city get ripped up in 2014.
Look, I think with every generational group, there's a different mode. What's yours?
Not necessarily that I've given up on my generation, but I feel that the younger generation coming up is so much more passionate. They're really into activism. I have a lot of hope for people that are going to social media and being these influencers in ways that are so positive compared to, you know, taking a duck-faced selfie and promoting some, you know, yoga pants. Like, we actually have people now use these channels to go head-to-head with politicians.
Okay, well, I want to hear some of your work.
Oversharing is on trend, but I never was a cornflake girl. I'll talk about what happened at Christmas, But just because a bunch of TMI types go online to spurt out every element of their lives like an overpriced, deconstructed cheese toastie, don't be assuming I'm going to dish out all that Holden Caulfield kind of crap. Mind you, if I wanted to run a blog, it'd shit all over the space junk that's doing the rounds. Coming in third for the top 10 blogs of 2014 was Willett Beard, where some dude writes about his grooming journey by sprinkling his hipster beard with wattle or desiccated smegma. And you can forget it being like the runner-up blog What Would Yeezus Wear, a basic WikiHow page on how chumps can dress like a fish stick. I don't remember what won. I can think of 100 better ideas for a blog. A contents homepage for a start. Anyway, it's not even March, but clearly the new must-do darling is Instagram. I've got the app, but it's not like I'm active on it or anything. If you haven't heard of the Insta yet, it's where those too lazy to blog can broadcast their life with a picture that's worth 1,000 hashtags. You just know come the end of the year it'll be topping the best of 2015 wank lists. All the kids are into it. My aunt loves Instagram. She's cooked. I bought Anastasia 500 Insta followers for her birthday. I thought she was going to cry. The only time I've actually seen her cry was when her husband bought her the Avoca Beach House. They work together in real estate, not in buying houses or renos, but in furniture rentals. They call it property styling. For an easy 10 grand, you too can pimp your pad for a week. Hashtag freedom. Hashtag magazine shootworthy. Absolutely cooked. Anastasia is one of those Gen Xers that embraces technology with both thumbs in order to look trendy. She thinks she's street smart, but if given the chance, she'd glad wrap her Adidas. She missed out on being an 80s kid by 1 year, and you know it just eats her. I've seen her slip out of situations to avoid revealing she was born in the 70s. She loves to act like we're twins, even though she's 11 years older than me. Since I started this program, first Wednesday of the month, Anastasia picks me up in Scarlet, that's her Merc, and treats me to lunch. I can bet you right now the meal won't touch the sides, but it'll add to the Facebook feed. Gives her a real buzz when we're out to have the waiter guess which one of us twins was born first. The waiter always plays along. I don't blame them. Beauty is in the eyes of the credit card holder, and tips go a long way when you're having to serve chumps. Today we're going to some joint called Catalina, where the sommelier's haircut will definitely cost more than my outfit. I figured I'd give contouring a whirl, make myself look like a real woman for lunch, one with cheekbones and a cute nose. I kinda have a large nose. Anyway, I'd saved this YouTube clip of a teenager who made herself look Amazon woman fierce in like 5 minutes and was watching that in the ambulant bathroom. She used 100 different brushes but made it look pretty easy. I discovered my chisel palette contour kit didn't come with one brush. Kit my ass. How are you meant to chisel without the damn tools? I made do with fingers and followed the video exactly, but I've come out looking like a shit-smeared shapeshifter too high on shrooms to morph properly between faces. I cop smirks from the snowflakes here, so I booked the Snuggie till lunch. The Snuggie is a room adjacent to the Ugg Boot. Apart from the toilet cubicles, they're the only private spaces in this place. They're mirror image of each other, except their lime and purple colouring is inversed, each containing a bicycle seat for a stool and a plastic flap which folds out from the wall like an aeroplane tray. The glorified phone booths popped up after some consultant with a diploma in life coaching or something facilitated a thinking outside the box workshop on empowerment. We were each given party hats to wear to remind us we were wearing our design thinking hats. Then we went to town like toddlers with coloured markers spraying brain farts on the wall. That's how the library nook was replaced with the two phone booths, why there's a ping pong table in the kitchen, and why the meeting room spawned new names. My unit's weekly pow-wow is now held in Roomy McRoom face. Anastasia is real proud of me for being here, even though this place is a revolving door of half-cracked attention-seeking junkies. I see right through the casual hatted chef lunches. It's all a ruse to check up on me. And sure, I get it. On paper, it looked like I was unravelling. 4 government jobs in 2 years looks sus, but it wasn't like that. Anastasia keeps telling me if I commit myself, I'll find my feet here, when really this place is like dragging your body face and tits up by your elbows through everybody's baggage. But I'm so over talking about this place. What I want to talk about is what went down in December when I resigned from Fucks and how I ended up in this program. Fucks is the Department for Families, Unemployed and Community Services. Government speak is all acronyms, but the department may as well represent itself with an empty money bag emoji. It's the dumping ground for povo policies, which is why the head office is next to some Korean barbecue joint in Strathfield and not in the city with the prestigious Premier's office or the Treasury.
I just love this work. It's just really good because it comes out so naturally. Does it give you satisfaction at the end of it? You just go, yeah, job well done.
No. No, I'm hoping that if I can get it to be the book and published,
yeah,
that's when I'll be like, yes.
How far away are we from getting this book?
Very, very, very far away.
No, don't say that. You're not allowed to say that.
Oh, no, I'm very happy for it to be far away. I've put a lot of research into this past year. A lot of what I want to say, it's so political, you know, the timelines and who was there and who wasn't. I've mapped out a lot of the book. I've done a lot of the heavy grunt work, which I actually enjoy.
Is that your voice or is that this character's voice? Tell me that.
I think it's a hybrid. The funny bits are me.
Is it easy to slip into that character? You've told me at times that it's difficult for you to pour these words out.
It's hard because it feels like I'm trying to be funny. It's because in my real life I'm so lame with my jokes.
No, you're not! But you are really funny.
Shall I keep going with a bit of chapter two?
Absolutely, yeah, please do.
Okay. So this is where the protagonist, is meeting with her manager. She's just resigned from the job though. And she works in housing. I nabbed an inside table by the open window and dragged over two glorified milk crates so there'd be enough seats for the four of us. It was like a seaman had lost his load inside the joint. There must have been about 50 of these oversized onion lights hanging at various lengths from the ceiling like jellyfish tentacles, their bulbs supplanted with spiral filaments of an angry orange. At one end of the cafe, a floor-to-ceiling shelving unit looked like an open advent calendar, its pockets interspersed with packets of coffee beans or nautical paraphernalia in shades of beach, a length of shipping rope tacked across the shelving in the shape of a Christmas tree. Instead of a star, atop sat a piece of plywood painted to look like driftwood, with the words, "The Caffeine Apothecary." The place was pretty packed, considering it was after lunch on a weekday. Under a low-hanging star-spangled banner, a mix of office workers and shoppers waited head in phones for their takeaway cup of fair trade hopes and dreams. Joy was late. It didn't bother me. I just didn't want her feeling bad that she was late. Much like Usain Bolt or Francine Prose, Joy completely encapsulates her name. I thought the constant cheeriness was an act. Even when I interviewed for the project support officer role in the first place, she couldn't stop laughing at some gif of some guy tripping and spilling a tray of coffees. She feels awful when she's late, though. And when you have kids, you're always running late. I don't want kids. I don't want kids ever. People are always thrusting their babies at me. It's Michael Jackson-type creepy watching people get off on sniffing a baby's head. I don't want to hold it. I'm not going to be the one to snap its neck or something. A waitress handed me a paper menu, letting me know she'd be my caffeine apotheosist for the day. When she returned to set the table, carrying red American College tumblers for the water, I noticed her wrist tattoo. It was a caffeine molecule, varying shades and size spears representing the elements of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen. I wanted to ask her if she knew those same elements in different compositions created cocaine, heroin, TNT, and thalidomide. I didn't say anything because she probably already knew. Both UTS and UCID are within walking distance to the cafe. She's probably a science major. I can always eat, but I didn't feel like eating anything at that cafe. I especially didn't want Joy paying for my meal just because I didn't have a job. When you have kids, you're always broke. Plus, she's mentioned sending money to her parents in Manila. They look after her sister's kids while her sister works somewhere in the UAE. The lighter dishes on the menu had avocado and Brussels sprouts. The sprouts were fried, and the avo dish came smashed with cheese on cornbread and sides of bacon butter and maple bacon. Somehow, I'd got water onto the bottom corners of the menu. Two dark patches raced up the sides, ploughing a path towards each other, forming a pincer attack around the list of extras. I couldn't remember if I'd lied and told Joy I had another job lined up. Lied only because I didn't want her to feel bad about me resigning and not having a job. There was a dirty sponge eggy smell to my tumbler which made me feel queasy. That's when I pulled out my phone to text Joy to say sorry that I had to bail. It's not like an exit interview with your manager is compulsory. The only thing I was required to do was return my fucks departmental pass, which I'd already done. Joy knew this. I only agreed to meet with her because I didn't want her thinking she was a terrible manager or anything. It was the housing department I was leaving, not her. It was too late, though. Joy had messaged. She had parked and the kids were looking forward to meeting me.
Thank you, Loretta. And I'm looking forward to getting your critique to listen to this.
Thank you.
Full of trepidation, that look. And now onto the critique part of our program with the astonishing Joseph Tewadros, who's joining us from London by Zoom. Welcome to the program. And you've just been listening to Loretta Jessop, and you're looking very seriously.
Well, I was listening intently, you know. I mean, you had to listen intently. I mean, there was so much detail, so much description that, you know, when someone's reading, yeah, you have to be attentive. Whereas if I was reading the book myself, I could take it at my own pace and,
exactly,
and savor each word, because I think every word is very carefully placed in her writing. And when they're flying very fast, I'm not smart enough to be able to catch it all. But great. I mean, that's something I definitely read. And she's very precise. And as I said, very intelligent writing and really very well nuanced. I had to definitely understand where it's coming from. And she definitely provides a snapshot of what we're all going through at this time.
Look, what I've loved about Loretta's work, the way she spins the whole female persona on its head a little bit. Instead of being the nice, neat, sweet girl, in fact, she doesn't want children. You know, she's afraid she's going to snap a baby's neck, and it's like hilarious. Like, yeah. I think to some degree, yeah, a lot of women feel like that, but nobody's got the courage to say it.
There is that definitely, like, courageous putting her head on the chopping board or whatever it is. But yeah, I really like how she described things. And also, the other, it doesn't really matter. I'm not some like literary genius. Play the oud, man. I'm just a guy hanging around, playing the oud. Oh, yeah, I'm going to critique some great writer. Yeah, well done.
Because Loretta is an introverted person, whereas you're a person who's been immersed in your creativity. How long? Like, when did you start playing?
Well, I've been probably professionally since 12. I mean, I worked jobs as a kid, and so that shaped me into being more extroverted. And then with the music side of things, I was a bit shy, especially because I was playing a, inverted commas, ethnic instrument. And so I didn't know how that would go about in Australian society. My parents were like, oh, go and play. And I'm like, well, I don't want to play this traditional song in front of someone. But then that changed when I realized actually there was something to provide and people were enjoying it. I became much more extroverted later. And then, of course, I dress in color and all that sort of mumbo jumbo. I'm not ever afraid to kind of just do what I want in terms of dress or music.
Your music is very introverted. Like, it seems to be drawn from that place.
Well, I think that's a good parallel. I'm always trying to look for the deeper, more emotional connections when I provide the music. And for me, the music is very much a healing, not only for myself, but for other people. And I find that a very important thing to do when you write with intent. That's also a good thing. It's what the intention is with writing. Do you want to bring to the sphere, I'm talking in a musical sense, but yeah, probably also in a, is what the intention. There is an underlying message to everything that is composed or created. That, I think, is something always important in any creative work.
Yeah. And so even though you're drafting this music and it's so intense and internal in a way, Loretta is almost like the complete opposite. She's so observational. Everything is about transcribing what's happening outside and giving it this beautiful slant of this is ridiculous.
But what I found interesting with a kind of parallel where she's very passionate about the generations coming up. But don't hear that in the writer. It was that where I just for a little bit of got to have a thread of hope.
Yes.
But she does give us a beautiful snapshot of what we live in.
I remember that joke that you gave one evening, and that was the same type of humour, in fact.
I'm always doing little jokes on stage, sometimes very rant, but I'm always following it with the music, you know, a juxtaposition of what I provide on the musical sense. So, you know, I've had the same, you know, when somebody critiques music and people don't know the intention behind it, or they don't know what you're trying to create, you are the only judge, essentially, to an artist who really has intention and is passionate about their work and knows what they're doing and knows what the message is behind their work. I approach it as that. Am I proud of this work if no one else is listening to it or no one else likes it? Because that's the way we're in, you know what I mean, in the arts, in music. But I can definitely see the frustration because there are barriers and things that are put on now that make it harder for people to create art and or just to be themselves.
Do you think Australia's got a very small market for artists?
Australia is brilliant. Australia, is in terms of talent, is brilliant. I mean, I've travelled the world. I have a wealth of artists, but there's nothing to really support them. I mean, there are some councils, of course, that provide funding. If you know how to do it, you know how to write. But in the, what can I say, the morale, the artistic morale in Australia is low. We have an amazing wealth of artists, brilliant musicians, brilliant painters, world leading, but there's nothing in the country and in the sense of unity in terms of the art. It's just a bit of free-for-all, and only the really brilliant people that really want to survive will persevere. And with, like, you've seen it in things like Corona, where artists are non-essential. And this is around the world now. It's kind of this type of low morale for artists, musicians, painters, anyone that ever undertook an artistic pursuit. And also radio stations, music that radio shows that I grew up on that would give me, you know, let me identify other musics or hear other musics are gone. Which is what Loretta described.
How are you finding it in London now? Because that's where you are at the moment.
I've been here since March. I did my last concert in Sydney, and then that was it. I finished my tour in March, and then I came back. I mean, it's pandemic. I don't know. Again, it's other people that really don't know what to do, telling other people that don't know what to do, what to do. It's just period. But again, the arts and music are being more and more pushed aside. I think we really kind of have to bring a focus to that. Otherwise, we're going to lose a lot of great artistic works. I remember a quote from an Egyptian movie, and it said, suffering inspires the strong and destroys the weak.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And, it was about this oud player that just kind of he'd had enough and he pawned his oud.
Are you making
No, that's a true story.
Okay.
It's a movie called Habib al-Amr, meaning Love of My Life, 1933 movie.
What kind of books do you read?
I just read things that depress me, like, you know, historical. I just, my whole life is fiction anyway. I need to know facts. At the moment, I'm reading My Life in the UK test because I've got to do a test. it's like one of those Become an Aussie tests where, you know, you've got to remember Don Bradman's cricketing score or something. So I have to remember kings and queens and who killed who. And I'm doing the Life in the UK test at the moment. So I have to read the book. Well, I've only got through chapter one. We'll see how we go.
So I'm dealing with writers who are as yet unpublished, and it's amazing to see people who are dedicating their time. Loretta's got a day job. She has to keep herself alive. Yeah. But doing the writing is what gives her passion, that clear, witty playfulness.
But it's very funny. Look, I would read that. I would definitely read that. That's it's a very entertaining, very humorous. If anyone's doing an audio, I'll put the speed down.
I thought you might relate to that thing about the ibis, because you know how in Australia she was saying that the ibis is seen as being a foreigner and somehow dirty and a bit like
I know
that.
I could relate to that, a dirty foreigner. Thanks, Maria.
No, tormenting your interviewer.
By the way, I want you to know, I love ibises, and because, you know, they're a big ancient Egyptian symbol.
Yeah.
You've got this godlike figure.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden it's just, you know, making garbage from bins. You know, talk about, you know, it's just like ibises. A fall from grace.
I see it as really majestic.
No one likes an ibis now.
Oh.
Ibis is something who had a great career and then did something and the whole world cancelled him or her out, and then they just, you know, picking through the garbage now and go, oh, look at that ibis, used to be an ancient Egyptian god once. If you call something a bin chicken, you're not, you know, that's it, you're done. My advice is always just find people that you like and you trust and know that have their best intention for you. And that's what I always do when I create a work. There's an Egyptian composer, Abdul Wahab, he says everything before it's released, before a concert, for instance, is like a war room. And you have to have a few people that you trust and you know come from a good place, because, you know, a lot of people that could critique you come from a jealous place.
Well, you know what's interesting about you is that you've got this huge range of audiences, because you've got your Sydney Symphony people, and yet you still seem to enjoy very much performing at places like the Camelot Lounge. Which is much more edgy, fringy people. How do you span that?
Because I'm a human being. You've got to be reaching out to everyone. I mean, I was brought up in Redfern, and you know, I'm not a posh guy. You get put in these certain situations. You play in the opera house. I love having the wide gamut. I love talking to all types of people. My music is very spiritual. But when I say spiritual, I think spirituality is about connection with your fellow human being. And so it's not a religious thing. For me, it's about learning more about other humans from all walks of life. And I'm sure Loretta will know that when she does her writing, it's about the people that she's met, every person from any echelon of society, walk of life or social situation. You'll be speaking to a homeless guy and they'll throw a gem at you. And that will stick with you. When you put yourself in more situations and different situations, then you will learn more, and in turn will make you more spiritual and more connected to your fellow human being.
But look, it's a generous spirited to do the critique.
No, thank you for having me. I mean, thanks. Your ibis from London. Love to you and Loretta.
This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program, produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH with the support an inspiration of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I look forward to your company next time.